Welcome back to Montreal.
Yeah, it's nice to be here, man. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to see you. So this is like a really interesting thing you're doing here. This is the first Miles thing we're doing here with this band. This is the first.
Oh, really?
Okay, so talk me through what's happening here. I'm excited to be here with you.
Well, let's see. 2026, Miles Davis would have been 100 years old. It's his centennial birthday. And so, of course, we have to do something special to honor him. Many things. I've done radio programs. You know, I have a radio program on Sirius XM. So I've got 3 episodes, because you need at least 3 to even get a basic idea of what Miles was all about. But the other idea I had was to put together the band that I played in with Miles in 1981. Miles had been in retirement from 1975, about then. And, you know, he's just, no one heard from him. He was just kind of holed up in his apartment. Every once in a while, there'd be a sighting, you know, like at a club or something like that. But for the most part, nobody heard from him. And then Dr. George Butler, who was his A&R guy at Columbia, started coming by the house just trying to kind of get him comfortable with the idea of coming back. Bill Evans, the saxophone player, ended up hanging out with Miles a lot. Dave Liebman, a former saxophone player, had recommended Bill Evans, but they didn't make any music. They just hung out, went to the gym, did boxing stuff. Bill just kind of hung out with Miles to get him comfortable. And eventually Miles put together a band, and Bill Evans recommended myself. He recommended Mike Stern.
You were already a veteran of the business at 21 years old, right?
I was only 21, but I kind of felt like a veteran.
Well, you know? In fairness, you were, yeah.
I had been, you know, working on record dates, playing with, like, Bill Withers, just the two of us, and I was playing on all sorts of records, man, with Elton John and Carly Simon and McCoy Tyner. It was, you know, it was, but I was still young. Roberta Flack, we did a lot of work with Roberta. And Luther Vandross, we were just cutting his demos. But I got this call from Miles, and the first time he called me, it was for a session. It was for a session at Columbia Studios, like right away. Like, he said, I need you in the studio. When? He said, like, an hour, 2 hours, something like that. So I showed up at the studio, and we cut tracks. We cut tracks for about 3 days. That ended up being for an album called The Man with the Horn, which was essentially his comeback album.
Yeah.
Mike Stern, Bill Evans, Al Foster, of course. Al Foster had been in Miles' band back in the 70s before Miles went into that reclusion, you know, but Al's back with him. Mino Sinelu ended up being the percussionist. And we did, like, you know, I stayed in the band for a couple of years. It's incredible just to be with him. It was incredible to be with him. It was also incredible to see what he meant to people, because he had disappeared for a while. And when he came back, man, everybody came to see him. I remember being in Japan, and I tell everybody, I couldn't see the end of the audience. We were outside in some huge, like, parking lot, and I couldn't see where the people ended. You know, it was just Miles' back. And he wasn't in great health at the time, but, you know, he was still Miles, and people were just thrilled to see him. So anyway, you know, I left after a couple of years to develop more as a writer and a producer. Came back to him a couple of years after that as a writer and a producer and playing. First album we did was Tutu. Anyway, to get back to your main question, I decided to celebrate Miles' centennial. Why don't we put the band back together? So called Mike Stern, Bill Evans, Mino, Al Foster, the drummer, unfortunately, is no longer with us.
Right. It recently passed away, correct?
Yeah, about a year and a half ago. So that was tough. But I'm using the drummer who's been playing with me for like 5 or 6 years, Omar Marshall.
Yeah, so I'm last time you were here.
From Philadelphia. And of course, you know, he's doing great. And also from Montreal, we had John Beasley playing keyboards. We've been just jamming, you know, just came back from playing together. So I'm really excited to present this celebration of Miles to the Montreal audience.
Now, this will be published after, so we can talk a little bit about, this isn't just the Marcus Miller era of Miles, you're covering Miles.
Yeah, well, what we're doing,
because people do want your era.
yeah, sure. But we're going to start with the stuff that we played on, you know, like Jean-Pierre and a bunch of songs from the man with the horn, and from the album called We Want Miles. When we got in Miles's band, when Miles came back, the record company, Columbia Records, they were like, Miles is back. And Teal Macero was Miles's producer from the 60s. He's been Miles's producer. So now Teal's like, we're recording everything because we never know when this dude's going to go back into seclusion, you know? So everything we did, like, for the first couple of months was recorded. They recorded us up in Boston, which was the first gig. They recorded us in New York at A.V. Fisher Hall, I think it was. And they recorded us in Japan. And those three performances, Teal pulled tracks from those three performances, and that comprised the album We Want Miles. And so that's why I decided to call the band We Want Miles, because that's so what good. Everybody calls us, you know, the band who played on We Want Miles. You know, in Japan, you know, to sell stuff, I think they still do it. When they were selling a product, they like to use catchy English phrases that don't make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's lost, you know, in translation.
Yeah, exactly. Lost in translation. When we watched that movie, we've all sat on that bed trying to fall asleep. You know, we've all laughed at the slogans, you know, good taste, happy time.
Right.
You know, stuff like that. So We Want Miles, you know, it's kind of like corny, but people enjoy the album so much that it just became accepted as the phrase and as the name of the band and the album. So decided to put the We Want Miles band together. So that's the story.
And first show here in Montreal at the Jazz Festival, which has been a place that's honored you and your music now for a while. This is incredible.
Yeah, man, I'm excited. I'm excited to show the audience this music. I'm excited to play it again.
Right, it's like you're going to really feel it for the first time, yeah?
Yeah, because, you know, we haven't done this in 40 years. You know, we had one show at the Blue Note in New York, which is what let me know that this was going to work.
Okay.
It was a few years ago. But we never toured together, you know.
Are you taking requests? I have one request.
What is that?
We're doing Groove the No Trouble podcast. What do you think my one request is going to be? Mr. Pastorius.
Oh, man, that's the one thing we didn't do because we played that last year here, you know, with my band.
Yeah.
And Russell Gunn just played such a beautiful, you know, solo on that. You know, he played the melody just really beautifully, but I didn't want to go to the well twice, you know.
I know, it's a niche thing.
Yeah,
Marcus,
yeah,
I'm
glad that you like it, man, because I'm very proud of that one.
Yeah, so when I think about that era of just music, it was really interesting to have him back and the excitement. I was really young back then. But I also remember people were kind of like, they wanted him to do what he did. And he was really exploring then. You come in, you're young, you're hot to trot. You've got a lot of tread on the tires. You're doing more with him. You're not just playing bass, you're composing. How are you balancing this idea of Miles and that desire to just transform? He really wanted to transform in that time.
Well, you know, Miles had already established that if you liked what he did in the past, you better buy the album. They're still available, you know, because look, man, he had John Coltrane and Red Garland and Philly Joe Jones in the 50s, and that was the most popular band in jazz. But by the end of the 50s, he started a new group, and that ended up being Herbie Hancock, Wayne Shorter, Ron Carter, and Tony Williams. So then that group was like, you know, probably along with John Coltrane, the most popular bands in the 60s. Next thing you know, man, he's plugging his trumpet into a wah-wah pedal and he's got Michael Henderson on electric bass and Chick Corea and Keith Jarrett playing electric pianos. So it's almost expected, even though, of course, there are a lot of people who were always disappointed when he stopped doing the stuff that they fell in love with. That's understandable. But he never let that kind of dictate what he was going to do. I mean, he's pretty serious about that. So when I got in the band, I said, okay, it's not even like worth it to study the stuff that he used to do because I'm sure he wants to find something different. And so when we were in the band, you know, we just kind of followed him. He wasn't given a lot of direction, but we had to just find something. We just had to find it, you know. And then a few years later when I started writing for him, Tommy LaPuma, who was the A&R guy at Warner Brothers, he was like, Miles wants to do something different. I said, how different? He says, different. He said, let me send you something George Duke did. And George had, you know, synthesizers and drum machines and everything.
Yeah, because the 80s was also crazy because we had the legends, but that whole GRP world was happening too, where there was like Lee Ritenour and just a real push there.
Yeah. So I said, okay, well, if Miles wants to do that, let me do a couple of demos. If you don't like it, you don't like it. So I did demos. First one was Tutu, a song called Splash, a song called Porsche. They all ended up on the Tutu album, but I presented it to Tommy. Tommy said, Miles is going to love this and start recording. I said, where's the band? He said, no, I want you to do it just like you did your demo. So, man, I'm overdubbing drums and keyboards and basses and guitars. And Miles came in a few days later and listened. He said, oh, let me know when you need trumpet. It was as simple as that, you know?
Yeah.
And I was only, you know, they only asked me for a couple of tunes, but once they heard how cool it came out, they said, we want you to finish the album. So I had to start writing again.
From a bass playing perspective, what are you thinking at the time? Are you thinking, because I think it's different when you're session, you're trying to understand the song versus you see an artist that you're writing, composing, but you're also trying to push you in this moment because you've got to be more aware that this is a real moment here.
Yeah, wasn't really, well, I'll tell you, Tutu, it started with the bass line, absolutely.
You could feel it.
But not because I want to establish anything. It's just like Tommy said, you know, let me know when you have something. And I hung up the phone and I heard boom, boom. And it's more just like, that's what Miles' face looks like when he's scowling at you. You know, it's like, so that one started from the bass, but I was really into the composition. I did most of the work at the keyboard. And then when it's time to lay down the bass, I just reacted to what I felt like the music needed. Hmm. It was never, ooh, this is my moment, you know? I was just doing what I thought was appropriate. You know, that's really important for me. Just, you know, do what's right for the music. Now, if it happens that I need something a little flashy or something a little extra, I'll do it. But if it doesn't, I won't.
I was getting ready for the conversation and looking at this, and 45 years, I mean, I took a real step back. So now you're with some of the people, you're revisiting. Mm-hmm. I've spoken to you before. I know that you don't necessarily love revisiting. You like moving forward. Mm-hmm. How are you thinking about it? How are you feeling? It's a long period of time to be thinking about, and just your skill and what you've done, documentaries, and it's crazy to me.
Well, you know,
like you seem as a kid, Marcus.
Listening to it, I'm going, oh, I don't know if I'd have done that again. You know, listening to certain things, you know, but there's also some things that I feel like I can bring to it now that will make the music, you know, relevant now, you know. So Miles was all about, look, I don't want to go back. But every once in a while, we could trick him, you know, like just start swinging when he wasn't paying attention. And then all of a sudden, he just starts playing what's appropriate and realizes that we're swinging, you know. And sometimes he'd stop, sometimes he'd continue. So it was always there, you know. You can't, like, completely ignore what you've done. But Miles was the guy who felt like, you know, I want to be pushing, you know. Think about it, man. Most musicians who were really well known established their sound when they were in their early 20s, right?
And lucky if they get beyond it.
They spend the rest of their life just honing, just polishing what they discovered in their early 20s. That's for the majority of musicians. You know, by the time you're 30, you're who you are, and you just kind of put it in different scenarios maybe, but you know, it takes a lot of you got to be really committed to evolving, to just continue to add stuff, you know. Miles brought stuff from the bebop, from the 50s, from the 60s into the new music. It's just that because the environment was so different and he'd shade it different ways, you know. But when we were working on this stuff, you know, I'd be at the mic with him, I'm sitting at the mic with him, and he started talking about Charlie Parker and Dexter Gordon and Dizzy Gillespie right before a take. And then I said, okay, let's run the tape. Let's put Miles on this tune. And I could hear the bebop. It's clear as day, you know, because that's just what he was talking about. But in a different environment, you know, and shaping it a different way, it's new.
Can you take that equation and apply it to your bass playing in your life from then to what we're doing now?
Sure. You know, you can hear, like, there's a song on one of the original Grand Theft Autos. This is by Tom Brown, who's my homeboy, trumpet player, bad trumpet player. It's called Throwdown. And anybody who spent time on GTA
will probably hear humming it in their head right now. Yeah, as yeah.
Anyway, you can hear like my sound. I was still very aggressive, you know, 19 years old, but you could hear. But if you play that, if you hear what I do now, you say, okay, it's the same guy, but you know, the sound is a little bit more shaped and what he's playing is a little bit more thoughtful, maybe, you know? So, you know, my thumb thing, you know, it's like, I was just, you know, New York, you had to be aggressive, man. You couldn't be like,
it was heavy.
Subtle, man. You had to go knock people over the
make
head.
Make noise.
That was the way to do it. But then I took that sound and put in a whole bunch of different environments, you know? So I'm playing that stuff on Miles Davis's record, you know, playing that stuff for Luther Vandross ballads, and I'm playing with my thumb.
It's unbelievable.
You know, but playing it, and it's appropriate, you know? So, you know, I was always trying to put myself in new environments and seeing if I could maintain my sound, you know, maintain that sound, which everybody associates with a certain era, like the 70s or something like that. And then I had to deal with the fact that the composer to Seinfeld, like, used, like, this whack-ass slap bass sample.
But it was a sample, like on a keyboard.
Yeah. He used this sample. So, you know, like I'm scoring movies, which I do a lot. You know, I can't use my slap bass sound because, you know, I hate even calling it slap bass because it's like, no, we're thumping and plucking.
Thumping and plucking.
But I can't use that because, oh, I'm not sure about the Seinfeld reference, you know, cracking up.
Yeah, that was my reference, yeah.
Yeah, especially since, you know, African-Americans, we didn't really watch Seinfeld that much. We're like, oh, yeah, okay, so all the white people going to think this is Seinfeld.
No.
Okay, no problem. But continue on. Find a way to be you and evolve at the same time. It's not that easy.
I want to talk a bit about Marcus Miller basses, because I think it's relevant to this, which is 10-plus years now. That's been going. The beauty of the original idea of make this instrument quality and affordable. Mm-hmm. This is a raging success with very high-end models, entry-level models. I think I told you last time we spoke that Shenvron Shrek, who was playing with Toto, mm-hmm. was on the road with two of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not even his backup. That was his main and his backup.
Yeah. It started off as people's backup. And that's why I said, look, man, I know you got your main acts, but if you play basically a five string, primarily a five string, you know you want a four string back there every once in a while because it gives you a different vibe, you know? So people were buying Sires just to have as their four string, or if they're a four string player, to get it as a five string because the investment wasn't so steep, you know?
Right.
But man, after a while, people started going, man, this bass sounds good, you know? Because the thing I like about it the most is that if you plug it in, and you record it, it sounds good. Mm. It sounds, you can shape it the way you need it to be shaped. We gave players a lot of options with the EQ, which might have been a mistake. Because, you know, a lot of guys messed up their sound. But I literally did a video on how the EQ works, particularly the mid-range, you know. And people are really enjoying it, man. It's just thrilling, man, to see how it's just like evolving.
But do you think about now in terms of how I push it forward or how, like, because, again, you've been doing this. And, like, I'm always fascinated when I speak to the players because they're just chasing tone. Mm-hmm. This is a bit different because you're building and selling these. This isn't a signature model. This is your business here.
It started off as a little signature model. But very soon, because I'm going, like, how many people want to just sound exactly like somebody else? You know, you do that when you're young.
Yeah.
But eventually, unless, you know, it's not that important to you, eventually you got to find something that can help you find yourself,
yeah.
You know? And I wanted to be part of that. I wanted to be a part of your journey to figure out who you want to be. So, man, you know, Sire was game. They're like, look, we'll make all these different types of basses. None of them are, like, as expensive as some other basses out there, you know? But they're kind of like Kia, you know, where there was, like, really entry-level cars, and as people became really fans of the brand, they said, well, we'll offer you, as you grow, we're going to grow with you. We're going to offer you different stuff, more high-end vehicles, you know. It's the same thing with Sire.
Well, it's unbelievable. I want to get a bit back to Miles. Do you know why he liked working with you, what he saw in you? Did you hear from him directly? Did you hear through others? Do you know?
Well, you know,
We're going to make you talk about yourself, your mind. Yeah,
when I first came for the first session, Miles was famous for giving really nebulous instructions, right? Come on, we're going to do a C minor. Al, play the New Orleans upbeat. So Al would just figure out what New Orleans upbeat meant to him and just play that. And then I just jump in. I wasn't waiting for him to tell me what notes to play or whatever. I was sure that was the way to work with him. If he didn't like it, he'd tell me he didn't like it. If he liked it, he'd be like, yeah, keep that going. Hmm. So, and I tell people this all the time, when I was coming up in an area called Jamaica, Queens in New York, there were a lot of band leaders who patterned themselves after Miles in terms of how they led a band. So getting vague instructions was not new to me.
Right.
Or even contradictory instructions, you know. You know, I know somebody, a drummer told me, man, the guy told me to put the bass drum in front of the beat and the snare drum behind the beat. I'm like, so what you have to do is ignore them and play it from your heart. If it works, it doesn't. If it doesn't, you gave it your best shot. And I think when I walked in that studio the first time, that's what I did. And he's like, you know, he's trying to give me a hard time, you know. What are you doing, man? You know, don't play so much. And then, you're not playing enough. You know, he's doing that stuff like that. But I was like, close your eyes and go for it, you know. And I think he appreciated that. When we finished our first full take, he said, y'all play like a bunch of sissies. And he didn't say sissies, he said another word. You know? And he walked out of the studio, you know. But I'm the last guy before the exit door. So he walks past me and he just gives me a wink. He just goes, I said, that's what I thought. You know, he's just giving people a hard time, having fun. The other thing about him was that I knew his entire history, right? A lot of people who were writing music for Miles at the time, they were contemporary people, right? And they didn't know anything about who he'd been since 1945, you know? A lot of cool tracks, because I heard some of the stuff that they almost put on records for Miles. Badass tracks, but there was nothing for Miles to play, you know? Mm. And if you didn't give Miles anything, a melody, a strong thing to play, he was just gonna, you know, play whatever comes to his head. And because I knew Miles and his most potent weapon would be a strong melody, I really focused on melody. Not to say that I wasn't trying to give him some badass grooves and stuff that was really contemporary, but for him to do, I gave him something very specific to do. I wrote out the charts, you know, the melodies, and I put it up on the music stand. And the reason I know that that worked is because when we were recording Tutu, which was the first one I wrote for him and recorded with him, I'm sitting at the music stand with him, and he's playing. He's just, you know, noodling around. I'm going, oh man, that's not what I wanted, you know. And then he stopped. He said, when are you going to tell me what the hell to do? Right? Mm. He said, I know you know exactly what you want me to do, you know. So stop messing around and start telling me what you want. So I started, you know, tentatively pointing to the letter A, you know. And he started playing it, man, you know. Hey, Marcus, go down to the five and dime and get me some reading glasses. I said, what's a five and dime?
Even I know what a five and dime is. Yeah.
I went into the first, you know, big department store, and there they are, the reading glasses. So got in the reading glasses, and man, we had a great time, man. We had a great time, me writing out stuff, you know. And I write that, and I says, is this too high? He said, okay, let me try it, you know. So having a good knowledge of him, and then when he started reminiscing, which he did all the time, he didn't like musically to look backwards, but in conversation, yeah. I heard more about Charlie Parker. Wow. And Bud Powell and Max Roach and all the famous bebop players, Dizzy Gillespie, then I heard about anybody from the 70s. You know, they were like his college years. You know, everybody goes back to their college years.
Nostalgia is strong.
Yeah, so he would, you know, so I'd hear him and I'd say, man, wait, but Dex was the guy who was clean. Wasn't he dressed, man? He said, yeah, man, he sent me up to Harlem. I was wearing Brooks Brothers, Marcus. I said, yeah. He said, no, but they thought that was too corny, so they sent me up to Harlem to get some threads, you know. I didn't like the way it looked on me. You know, stuff like that, man. So we really got along, you know. And if you believe horoscope, Gemini and Gemini, you know, we both were like all over the place.
I'm a Gemini. Yes, I know what you're talking about. So we're going to jump forward now. We want Miles. You decide to pull the trigger. The guys say yes. Mm-hmm. you start looking at the music again? At what point? And tell me what happened from a bass playing perspective. Were you surprised? Was what? I'm just curious about certain moments where you were revisiting it, going, "Wow."
There was, first of all, choosing which songs was easy because we played basically the same set for a couple of years.
Okay.
With the We Want Miles band. So there's about four or five pieces. Then it was about what else do you want to do? And I know when I was writing for Miles, there's maybe four or five really popular pieces there. So finding the songs wasn't that hard. As a bass player, I was, it's more like, you're tickled to hear like your 21-year-old self.
It's an amazing gift.
You're going, okay, oh man, I forgot about that, whatever it is, you know, that pattern or that thing. And then other times, like, Marcus, you did it. You know, as I'm listening, going, don't play, you played.
Oh, you thought you were going to go there and went there and you're like, no.
I was scared he was going to go there and he went there. I'm talking about myself, but all those emotions, man. But in general, it's just like, you know, can't believe that, you know, you had the opportunity and it sets you off on another thing, because once Miles says he likes what you're doing, you really don't care what anybody else says anymore, you know? I mean, it wasn't that important even before that because I was so, you know, into finding stuff for myself. But once he gave me the okay, I was like, okay, I'm going for what I know, you know, and I'm not worried, you know, anybody who doesn't like it, they just don't like it, but I'm going for mine.
After the documentary about you, I felt that there was this really beautiful encapsulation of what I would call your legacy. I know as we get older, we don't like to talk about legacy, but there's reality. You are to a certain degree now preserving Miles's legacy, one aspect of it. Do you think about that? Do you have it as a weight? Do you think about how you want to evolve? Do you think about what would Miles think if he were backstage here in Montreal?
Well, yeah, I do think about that. I mean, he probably would hate it.
Well, you know, just for the nature of what it is.
The nature of what it is.
He'd probably hate being 100 too, if we're being honest.
Yeah, yeah. But I know I would say to him, this ain't for you. This is for everybody who misses you terribly. This is for everybody who fell in love with each era of your life, you know, each whimsical musical direction you took. You created a whole new fan base of people who just loved you. So you just need to sit down and just take it, you know? And I'm sure on a deeper level, he would really, really be proud.
How are you feeling? How are you doing as a bass? I mean, you are relentless in your work. You're always balancing. How are you feeling about the bass, what you're doing in the world? Because I see your name.
Feeling great, man. Feeling like, you know, it's harder to do the same thing, not just for me, but for everybody. You know, it's really... you know, I used to just say, look, well, we're going to sell a lot of records with this one, you know, but nobody's buying records anymore.
Yeah, it's a different world from that, yeah.
And the other, like, accolades, like the Grammys, I didn't even pay attention because Grammy, no, we sold 1.5 million copies on David Sanborn. You know, that's pretty cool, yeah. Especially since we didn't compromise anything. We did exactly what we wanted to do. But now it's like, you know, I see young musicians, I mean, I got to get my Grammy, you know? I say, oh, okay, it's a whole another set of goals, you know? And, you know, a lot of stuff is online now and a lot of guys are really posting stuff, 8 bars, you know? It's a badass 8 bars.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I'm wondering, well, are these people who can react in a musical environment, you know, when you got other guys who are throwing stuff at you, when you got to leave space, you got to support other people, you got to know when a fat downbeat is necessary, you know?
The intestinal fortitude of doing an hour.
Yeah, but it's not even just music, it's just like interacting with people, you know, that's the kind of stuff you got to know, you know? You know guys who, when you're talking, you can hear them thinking about the next thing they're going to say instead of really listening to you. And the musicians who are like incredible to me, they got big ears, you know? Herbie Hancock, man, you play something, man, you'll hear him repeat it back to you while you're improvising, you know, just supporting you. George Duke, you know, these guys are incredible because they got ears, not just fingers.
Yeah. You know?
And I think this is the
this is the era of fingers, you know. But man, that ear stuff. Larry Graham said to me, Marcus, is anybody playing anything that you walk away singing, you know? Is anybody playing anything that, you know, is memorable? You know, not just, ooh, that guy's bad, that guy has such technique. Is anybody playing anything memorable? Any bass lines that, you know, you just go, whoo? You know, because that's what we used to do when we heard Larry Graham. It's like, whoo! So just adjusting and just recognizing that things are changing. So, you know, of course, there's things you hear and go, oh, I'm using that. You know, I'm going to see what that sounds like coming through my filter, you know. And then other times I'm going, okay, I hope this isn't your end game, this video clip. I hope this is just kind of like a snapshot.
Right.
You know, and you're on your way to something else. You know?
It is interesting to me to see guitar players adapting bass techniques now.
Yeah.
That I find super interesting.
And vice versa.
For sure, vice versa. But I think vice versa was always the case where bass players were trying to follow guitars. Watching guitar players' fingers and hands look like bass is wild to me.
Yeah, yeah. You got a point there. It's pretty crazy. But, you know, the thing is that everyone's learning with their eyes now.
YouTube. You know?
We had to learn with our ears. And you can hear that. You know, we had to learn. Mm. We had to take that needle on the vinyl, man, and keep running it back and keep running it back and trying to hear what was going on, you know, and figure out on your own how to get to it. And that doesn't happen now, which is great because you spend a lot less time trying to figure out how to do something. But also, we found so much stuff thinking that this was the way that Stanley Clarke played it.
Right.
This was the way Jaco played it.
Right.
And next thing you know, it wasn't anywhere near the way they did it, but you found something of your own.
Hmm.
And that's pretty cool too. So each generation has its pluses and minuses, you know.
It must be fun being in a world where you get to do bass battles with Les Claypool also. I heard about that, Marcus.
Oh, that was fun. Yeah, Les called me. He said, we're going to be at NAMM. And there's this...
Bass Magazine Award.
Bass Magazine Award, yeah. And he said, man, would you sit in with a tune? And I said, yeah, man, I think I'm going to be free. You know, I'm going to be there, but I had to move something out of the way, you know, and got there and I hung out with him. We had a good time.
I heard it was quite the battle.
It wasn't a battle.
It's on YouTube, but everyone can see it.
It's hilarious, man. Yeah. We're just goofing around. But the thing is, even then, you can hear us listening to each other, complimenting each other.
Mm.
You know, it wasn't just, this is lick I practice in my hotel room, you know. This is, no, let's see what we find out there, you know. I like those.
What's we're doing this now, it's new, but are you planned out for the rest of the year? Do you know what's happening with you? Is there new music happening, sessions? What are you up to?
We have 5 weeks in Europe of this tour.
Yep.
With the We Want Miles. I just finished scoring a Chris Rock movie.
Oh, cool.
It's coming out in a couple of months. Really interesting. Not a comedy, really. So something really different for him. Really special. I do a weekly radio show, working on the next album.
Cruise?
And I have the third cruise of the year is coming up in September.
I think, yeah, Vancouver. Is that right? That it's leaving from Vancouver?
Yeah, we're leaving out of Vancouver and sailing south. Going to stop in, like, Napa and San Francisco and then down to L.A. You know, usually we leave out of Miami and go into the Caribbean, but we're starting to branch out, go to different places.
Last question-ish area is I'm curious about how you're seeing all this technology, AI, what people are doing. I'm getting tracks from people who are speaking bass lines into this Suno thing, and it's coming back. And do you play with this stuff? Are you excited about it? Does it terrify you? Where are you at?
I goof around with it, and it's fun, you know. And I don't know where it's gonna end up, you know. On one level, I think that, man, is the 20th century gonna be the last century for farming music, meaning this is where all the original ideas came from, you know, and then everything else is referencing the stuff that happened up until the 20th century, you know. And if so, wow, what an honor to have lived in that century, you know, if everything now is a computerized reference to something that already happened, you know.
But you believe that? I don't. I think the value of humans and real is going to have a delta and be worth more.
It depends on if the music is the focus of whatever the endeavor is.
Okay.
Music commercials?
No, for sure not. No, I'm talking about the heart of making music, why it
hits. It's gonna put a more of a premium on premium. Individuals, you know, absolutely. But a lot of the second tier, third tier music work, because that's what keeps a lot of people
for sure,
is gonna be gone. A new filmmaker is gonna go, I'm just gonna have AI do my film.
For sure.
You know?
For sure.
And so the young film composer, I mean, I always advise guys to find a young filmmaker, man. Score his movie, you know, and just get your chops. And if this guy fools around and gets a hit, guess what? You're his guy. You're his person, you know. But now, you know, they're going to go, hey, can you give me a score that sounds like John Williams meets Quincy Jones?
Yeah, or they won't even ask a musician. They'll just have somebody program it. But I do, you know, again, where's the quality? It's always a Quentin Tarantino or...
Yeah, you'll be able to tell, but... But not everybody's discerning enough to care.
Yeah, that's the care part.
You know? Yes, if you see somebody who's an artist, who's different, who clearly sees the world differently and can express that through music, oh, that's always going to have value. And your ability to get on a stage and entertain people, I think that's always going to have value. But those other industries, man, I played on jingles, man, for 20 years.
Yeah,
that was our bread and butter in New York. We played on music for commercials from 8 a.m. till about 11:30, and then we went and did record dates or whatever, and then we played in the club at night, you know? I don't think that's gonna be around, you know? Unless it's like some really specific, you know, we need this band to sound like the Beatles. Okay, well, yeah, but.
I want to go back because I did have one question about Tutu. It's now a landmark album. Did you feel it at the time? Did you understand what it was? Even after it was released and people felt it.
Okay, well, when I finished working with Miles that day, we used to take cassette tapes back home.
Yeah, listen to them in the car, yeah, if you were lucky.
In the car. So they sent a car to take me from the hotel back to the airport to go back home to New York. And I was scared to put the cassette in the car player, because I'm going to please sound as good today as it did yesterday, you know. And Luther Vandross and I always used to laugh about, please not make sure it wasn't just something I ate yesterday that made it sound so good.
Yeah.
And put it in, I go, whew, nope, sounds exactly the same. I was very happy and really didn't care about anybody else, because it was just like, this sounds good, you know, and I was really excited. And then I went to Miles's house, man, and Rick was out. He said, man, thank you, man. You brought me back, right? To hear that from a person is special. To hear that from Miles, I couldn't care less what anybody else felt. I didn't care if it lasted or it was just for the time. You know, because music, you know, everybody has a different idea of what music should do. But for me, music needs to be a reflection of the time you live in it. You know, when you hear like a Bach etude, you say, okay, yeah, there was a harpsichord going on, man. Dudes were wearing wigs, you know. You get the whole thing.
That was their punk, yeah.
And if you're fortunate and the future is kind to you, your music will last and become quote-unquote classic, but you don't have any control over that. You don't know which way the time is going to bend, you know, which way taste is going to change. So, you know, I remember talking to a guy who said, man, Marcus, you know, jazz traditionalist. Man, you know, that stuff that y'all do is so for the moment, you know. And I say, yeah, that's true. But what about Herbie Hancock's Headhunters? He said, well, that's a classic. He said, yeah, but it wasn't a classic when he recorded it. I said, y'all are cheating, man. Y'all are playing classic music that you didn't create. You just, you know, playing what Charlie Parker and them sweated to figure out, you know. And, of course, I enjoy hearing people playing bebop. So I was just kind of arguing the other side against this guy. But my point is I think still holds, is that you don't know if your music's gonna last. When we were recording Luther Vandross stuff, man, we were just making it sound good. There was one song when Luther sang a remake of a song called Superstar, right? Where I, as I'm playing the track, and Luther's singing live with us, I said, I'm going to be listening to this for the rest of my life. You know, I knew that that was going to be, because he was just, his performance was just incredible. So I played a couple of licks to say hello to my older self 20 years later, you know. But you have no control over that. You know, do the best you can for the moment.
Well, I think you're a contemporary and a classic, Marcus. We all appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, man.
Thank you.
My pleasure.